Good morning, and thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. I am the Robin part of that, and I appreciate you coming in. If you have any questions or comments you want to make, call 790-2040. And today, our show is focused on a number of things, but one is socially just education. So I don't know if any of you caught it. About a month ago, there was Betsy DeVos was interviewed by she was presenting the education budget for the United States, and she was interviewed in Congress about her education budget. And Representative Clark, who is out of Boston, asked her about some research she'd done. There was a thing that had been put in place that was guidelines that said, wait a minute, we're suspending African American boys at 3 times the rate of their peers and African American girls at 6 times the rate of their peers. Something's not right. And so we want you to look at other programs. We want you to look at restorative justice or to look at your own practice and see why these numbers look like this. And our current Secretary of Education often relies on personal belief, anecdote, research that either doesn't exist. For example, her claims that students do better in larger classrooms, which she's promised to release that research because no one has seen it, or research that is so outside the norm it's not considered credible. This was one of those things. And the research she cited says, differences in rates of suspension between racial groups thus appear to be a function of differences in problem behaviors that emerge early in life and that remain relatively stable over time and that materialize in the classroom. As a parent, I love that idea that you are born, that you have a bad baby when you bring that kid home, and then the baby tricks you by being good for a few years. All of a sudden, you take the kid to school, and reality hits in, and the bad baby is back. This is not actually how it works. So we have two guests today, Dr. Shezaray Warren and Dr. DeMarcus Jenkins, who have studied and care about issues of race and equity. They are both saints in my point of view because they are both former middle school teachers. One of them also a high school teacher. I bow to you for doing taking that job on. So Dr. DeMarcus Jenkins is an assistant professor of education policy studies and practice. As I mentioned, he's been a high school and middle school teacher. His scholarly research interests draw from his previous experiences as an urban school educator and state level policy analyst. And I was going to mention some of your scholarly work, but actually it's so above my head that I thought I would just give the small background and then ask each of you to talk about your scholarly work. Thank you. So our second guest, Shezaray Warren, was born and raised in Illinois, and he's been described as a professor, a scholar, an activist, and an author. He is a nationally recognized researcher in the field of urban education and teacher education, and he's here because he's here in Tucson because he's giving a talk Monday, 2 days away at 5:30 at the University of Arizona College of Education. And the name of the talk is Race, School Choice, and the Politics of Transformation. It is in the Integrated Learning Center at 1500 East University and begins at 5:30. I have watched videos of him, and he's fantastic. And you will soon hear how fantastic he is. His work is centered on improving the educational outcomes of young Black men and boys across the P20 education pipeline. His latest book is Urban Preparation, Young Black Men Moving from Chicago's South Side to Success in Higher Education. And so right now, if each of you could take a few minutes and talk about the scholarly work.
Brains are for beauty. good morning. Thank you so much for having me on this morning. This is Shezaray, should I?
This is Dr. Shezaray Warren, and you should move your mic a little closer, right in front of your mouth. Perfect.
There we go.
It covers our face, but
okay.
It works
okay.
Better.
Oh, this is good. All right, nice. So I'm really happy to be here. Happy to be in Tucson. I was telling DeMarcus that my kneecaps made their debut yesterday in 2019 because it's still kind of cold in Michigan, so I'm really happy to be here. So my work broadly is I'm interested in the school conditions and the teacher dispositions that support high academic outcomes for young Black men and boys, and I study that in two ways. One, I'm looking at student-teacher interactions for evidence of empathy and the ways that empathy as a professional tool can be useful in how teachers learn to communicate and respond across racial and cultural difference with young Black men and boys. And I've done that work primarily in high school And trying to now move and expand the reach to middle school to sort of understand that particular time in one's development. And then I also study this by actually having lots of conversations with young Black men and boys about the inside and outside of school factors they believe really support their being academically successful. And so in that work, I've studied how Black boys make sense of navigating the space between home and school, the ecology of people, moments, incidences, and experiences that they believe really add substantively to their sort of shaping their education trajectory. So that's sort of it in a nutshell.
All right, thank you. And Professor DeMarcus Jenkins.
Good morning. So my work broadly defined centers around the relationship between urban social processes and educational processes. So I'm really interested in the way neighborhoods and communities change, be that through gentrification or some other urban social process, and how does that impact schools and create and reshape really what we come to understand as schools and the process of learning, and how do those changes create new patterns of inequity? Like, what's happening in schools when neighborhoods are changing? And I'm also interested in the ways that educators, but be that teachers and principals, contend with those changes. So how do those changes impact the practices of educational stakeholders within the school, and how do they make sense of that within their work? So my work is qualitative in nature. I'm really interested in hearing from the people. So I do a lot of interviews with community stakeholders, teachers and educators and parents, and talking about how do they experience those changes, and how do those changes impact their everyday decisions that they make around educational about their own and their child's educational options.
Great, perfect. So this is, you could do the interview because you're used to talking to people. So one of the things I wanted to ask Dr. Warren, who is the visitor who is coming from Michigan and giving the talk on Monday, is I watched this video of you giving a talk on empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting to me. One is that you talk about using empathy as a tool, and one of the examples you gave is that using empathy is a matter of practice, as something that teachers can learn strategies to do. They don't necessarily have to be empathetic to start with. You gave an example of a woman. Well, I'll let you tell the teacher who was not empathetic. who did not want to hug the children.
Yeah. Well, part of my learning and studying empathy is we tend to have a picture in our head about what empathy sort of looks like. Mm-hmm. And social neuroscientists would say that we all have the capacity to empathize, that is something that we're actually born with. And so part of what I've learned is that because we're all different, how that empathy sort of shows up will vary significantly based on a number of social factors. Personality, years of experience in a particular context, familiarity with the what scholars will call the target of the empathetic act or the expression of empathy. And so you can be someone who is maybe not as warm and not as emotionally, you may be perceived as not as emotionally connected, and still demonstrate evidence of empathy in the ways that you are making sense of someone else's experience, and the ways then that you respond to their needs based on what your understanding of their points of view. So I think what's been I guess compelling in the work that I've done is that I've studied teachers who have been identified as really effective based on the testimony of students and families and administrators, but teachers who are all very different in the ways that they interact and choose to interact with young people. And so then my work is not really concerned with, can someone be empathetic or trying to measure the degree to which empathy is expressed, but rather if this is a human capacity that can be useful in improving the quality of student-teacher interactions, specifically and more pointedly, human connection, if empathy can really support the ways that people who may show up as very different from the person who's responsible for teaching, if that teacher can build a human connection with them that is substantive, then that teacher is going to be better positioned to respond to their needs in ways that more often than not produces favorable outcomes in terms of the interactions that they're negotiating.
That is interesting. A number of years ago, 30 years ago, I was on this committee for a district, and they wanted to develop a chart of what a good principal looks like. Mm-hmm. And what was so bizarre about that is I work with a lot of principals, and there are principals that are that warm, fuzzy person.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also this amazing principal that I worked with who actually was kind of sarcastic. She was an elementary school principal, and the kids would say, you know, they'd come up and want to give her a hug, and she'd, I guess so, go ahead, you know, what's in it for me? But she had this very sarcastic way about her, and her students loved her. The teachers felt totally supported with her, but on that rubric, she would have never made it because she didn't look like an empathetic principal.
Mm-hmm.
She looked like kind of a cranky person.
Yeah. I think, like a lot of industries, but in education in particular, we are... we love standards. We love to standardize everything. Everybody needs to look, talk, be, and perform the same. And if we can standardize it, then we can measure it. If we can measure it, then we can tell who is good and who is bad. And that's just not the way humanity works. You know, we're all different on purpose, and our differences actually is the thing that adds the value to making a place of learning a place that is interesting and compelling. So I think part of what this work is trying to do is to make the case, one, that we should be concerned about the ways that education as a human enterprise is a humanizing enterprise, and how it is that we can continue to make it that, and to value folks who show up however they're showing up, but who make priority building substantive relationships with young people that is student-centered. The students' perspectives and ways of seeing the world is sort of central to the educator's decision-making.
Okay, we are going to go for a break right now, but when we come back, we'll be talking to Dr. DeMarcus Jenkins and Dr. Shezare Warren. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we are here this morning with two experts on changing the school-to-prison pipeline. And Dr. Shezare Warren is here, and also Dr. DeMarcus Jenkins. And DeMarcus, can you tell us about... I'm going for DeMarcus.
That works.
Sorry. can you talk about your research?
Sure. So, like I said earlier, I'm really interested in the way that neighborhoods and communities alter. So I'm thinking about processes like gentrification, thinking about urban social development. I'm thinking about the decisions that city officials make to restructure and reshape neighborhoods, and how those decisions also impact the schools within those areas, right? So when we think about gentrification as the process of displacing a particular race, a group, a class, group of people, how that allows for the land to be ready or the neighborhood to be ready for a different group to move in. What then happens to the school that's situated in that area? Are the same students who live in that area able to attend those schools, or do they have to make different decisions about where they are educated? Why are certain communities forced to make those decisions while others have the option, if you will, to select different types of schools? So I'm really interested in that relationship. And then related to that, I'm also interested in the way that teachers and principals make sense of those changes within the school, and how do those changes impact the ways that their work is altered? So I did a study that looked at those issues in a particular urban neighborhood, and really trying to have the teachers and the administrators identify what were the outside of school factors that they felt were impacting their work. So how were things like demographic change outside of their work, or the raising of a local public housing, for example, how were those things impacting what was happening at the school, and how did that force them to think about the way they educated students differently, think about what did that mean for public school teachers to then have to go out and recruit students, right? Because there's this push for having adequate enrollment, if you will, to keep schools from being closed. So just really thinking about how those things shape what our teachers and educators are now being required to do inside of schools.
So there's also an impact on, the reverse is true, there's also an impact, I used to work for the city, and the funding was being cut, this is a long time ago, and so they were closing schools.
Mm-hmm.
And to close a school in a neighborhood is very hard on the neighborhood and the city. And what happens to that neighborhood is like this. I'm doing an example of going down. Yeah. It's very difficult. And the schools are this integral part of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of changes do damage to both sides. Mm-hmm. Students in the school and the neighborhood.
Yes, sorry, okay.
So what have you found are the solutions?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Just to the point of like school closing, like that has been a policy solution that we have seen more and more in urban cities and neighborhoods across the country. I know that part of Dr. Warren's talk on Monday is going to touch on some of that phenomenon, looking at Chicago and here in Tucson as well, and really trying to understand the impact of those school closures. I think one of the things that we learned from that is before schools are actually closed, there is this deliberate disinvestment in schools. This is deliberate mm-hmm. disinvestment in public education, right? So there's this process to remove or to limit resources from a particular school or particular set of school, type of schools, to remove those resources so that it makes the communities who do choose to attend those schools, if you will, disadvantaged in more ways than they have historically been disadvantaged, right? So then those communities are often forced out of those schools. Those communities are often pushed out of those schools. They're dispossessed and displaced from those schools, which then makes it ready, if you will, right? It then almost perpetuates this narrative that the school is under-enrolled or underperforming or failing mm-hmm. in all of those measures mm-hmm. so that the school can be closed, and right? Yeah. And then right. policymakers feel that has a justifiable reason.
What they do here is they starve the schools
yep.
and then say, why aren't they doing a good job?
Exactly. Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
DeMarcus mentioned this, so I thought I would bring it up. In mm-hmm. You're from Chicago, where they did, you know, Rahm Emanuel, the massive 50 schools closed in one day. Most of those schools, the kids who attended, primarily African American schools. Mm-hmm. This was a number of years ago. It was a horrible thing, and now we're a few years on. And how has that impacted the students who are in those schools? Or is that go ahead.
Well, I can't speak super specific to how it's impacted particular groups of kids, just only because I've been away and my work has not been in Chicago in those spaces. But I just actually read a book with my class called Ghosts in the Schoolyard, and I would recommend that book. Author's Eve Ewing, a professor at University of Chicago. And she talks a lot about the ways that when we talk about school closings, we cannot talk about that phenomena outside of its historical context, mm-hmm. specific to how it is that a school becomes a bad school, worthy of closure. And we know in some data that I was looking at not too long ago that with the increase in the number of charter schools, there has been a decrease in the number of enrolled students in traditional public schools. And the thing that they tend to cite, particularly in Chicago, the thing that they cited most with why they closed those schools was they were underutilized. Mm-hmm. And so it was fiscally irresponsible to have schools with capacity of 500 or 600 kids that only had 100 kids enrolled. But at the same time, the district opened and granted charters to a tremendous number of charter schools. So those kids are going to other charter schools mm-hmm. in the same neighborhood where the traditional neighborhood public school is closed. And so part of my conversation on Monday is to say, besides the I'm closing the school because it's underutilized and I'm opening charter schools, the opening of charter schools tends to be centered on this conversation. Well, parents deserve choice with where their kids go. They deserve to have options. And I would argue that, yes, parents do deserve to have options. One of those options, including a high-quality school that is a block away from where that child lives. And so if the options requires that they actually have to leave their neighborhood to find a high-quality school, I think that's a fundamental problem with public schooling in a particular place. And this trend is not just Chicago. It's every major city, really, in the U.S., Tucson included. So, yeah, I think, and what Eve Ewing talks about in that book is this concept of institutional mourning. What happens in the wake of a school closure, particularly when families who lived in a particular community have for generations sent their children to a particular school, and what that school then means to that family is more than just a place to go and read and write. There are people and memories and moments and legacies that get erased when a school is closed. And if the only reason is underutilization and we're not willing to point to the historical factors that led to that school's underutilization, then we're doing those families and those communities a grave injustice.
Yeah, one of the schools that got closed later or was threatened to be closed later was Dyett High School, which was the last high school.
She talks about it in the book. Yeah,
yeah, in the neighborhood of Bronzeville, and this high school had amazing. All these incredible musicians had gone to it.
That's right.
The school had a different name at a different time, and the name was changed to honor the music teacher at that school. Mm-hmm. And they went on a 41-day strike that led by Brother G2 Brown, who's been on our show before. And it's just so sad that we think of this, the head of that that town, that city, Rahm Emanuel, and the damage he's done to education, to communities, to how he's handled shootings. It is just, there is never a time, I shouldn't say that, there's hardly a time where you see that he is on the on the side of protecting children and protecting what is right.
You know, I think that's interesting, right? Because we think about the, if we really like think about and unpack some of the logics that go into contemporary education reform policies, right? We think about this idea around increasing competition. We think about this idea around providing choice and options. And that's a particular rhetoric that is racialized in ways that have far too often disadvantaged low income and communities of color. It's this idea that if we force everybody to compete in the market, and we increase this, if we increase the options that people have in the market, then they can then compete for these limited resources, and only those who have the particular capital can survive in this market. And I think it's that approach to reforming education that is fundamentally undemocratic. It's fundamentally not. It's injustice, right? It's a form of injustice that is assaultive to the communities who have, again, connecting it back to history, who have historically been disenfranchised and marginalized.
Exactly.
And we see that not only in education, but in other sectors as well, across society, right? But it's this common sense idea that competition, right, that competition is good for organizations and institutions to thrive, and that people, individuals have this choice or this rational, these rational choice options, or individuals exercise rational choice in order to operate within the market. And I think that it's a flawed logic.
I was just going to say quickly that sort of logic, that market-based sort of logic, necessitates winners and losers, and it necessitates always somebody being on the bottom. And you can't use the rhetoric of all kids deserve and all kids should have access to equal opportunity if you are also then going to say that all people deserve options that require some schools and some neighborhoods be positioned as bad.
Yeah.
Right. And we see an interesting example of that in Arizona, where the governor has a program that rewards schools that are doing well and by giving them extra money. Now, we're sometimes on some lists, we're 49th, others 50th in per pupil spending. And you're going to reward schools that are doing well. Well, it's the greatest number of schools that are doing well are in certain neighborhoods and have and more importantly have a certain level of wealth, and that is a huge thing. So to compensate for that, he's offered schools that are low income that are also doing well. But when you divide the money up, three quarters of the money is going to the wealthy schools. Mm. And we have so many things that create inequity in Arizona. Yeah. We have tax credits. Mm-hmm. And those tax credits are easier to raise in wealthy neighborhoods. And we have schools that are raising $82,000 for trips to Catalina Island in California, mm-hmm. and schools that are raising $300 mm-hmm. to get books for kids. This is not going to help us in the long run.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't create a world where you only have about 8% of the kids getting a great education.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But see, it's funny, right? Because for example, if the state of Arizona can institute this competition process in which, right, certain schools can compete for this money, that obviously shows that there is money available to increase per pupil spending, right? There is the money out there. Why not make different decisions about how that money is allocated in the first place, instead of on the back end saying now these schools have to compete for the money that they should be getting anyway, right? So it's this perpetuation of this market strategy to really pit schools against each other and have parents, yes, and communities, right, be the really just kind of falling within that and being in some ways trapped in the decisions they're able to make around schools.
Yeah, and it takes the focus off the city and off the district for remedying and dealing with the root causes of inequality. Because these incentives like that become Band-Aid fixes that don't actually deal with the roots of racism and, you know, white supremacy that got us to this point, mm-hmm. right?
Right. We have to take a quick break, and we will be back in just a second. I'm speaking with DeMarcus Jenkins and Chezeray Warren. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we are here with our guests, Professor DeMarcus Jenkins and visiting Professor Chezeray Warren, who is going to be speaking here on Monday at 5:30 at the University of Arizona Integrated Learning Center, and which is at 1500 East University Boulevard. It's right in front of Modern Languages. I believe it's the underground one?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and he's going to be talking about race, school choice, and the politics of transformation. So we appreciate you guys taking time off your Saturday.
Thank you.
So one of the things I wanted to ask DeMarcus is about teaching in D.C. under Chancellor Michelle Rhee, who is not one of my heroes. I'll bring up one of my heroes. It's not Rahm Emanuel, mm-hmm. and it's not Michelle mm-hmm. Rhee.
You know, Michelle Rhee is, in some ways, the embodiment of a lot of the problems that we have seen in education reform over the past several years. She was the chancellor of D.C. Public Schools, who was appointed by the mayor, which is, if you think about what that looks like, right, when you have an elected official who then identifies one person to run the school, that takes out community input on who should serve in that role, right, and kind of what that looks like. We see a lot more leaders of school districts being called chancellor and being appointed by the mayor. So we see a lot of that happening more. But she embodied a lot of that. And her approach to fixing schools, if you will, was to fire en masse lots of veteran teachers, lots of veteran principals. She really she went into the central office and fired lots of people who worked in the central office who had been there for years, who had the institutional knowledge and the structures in place to really make DC schools thrive. Her approach to education didn't really value the historical perspectives of the people who had worked there for a long time, did not value the ways that schools and communities were connected, did not value the perspectives of students and families who chose to attend those schools. And I think also related to that, it was this, part of her work was, her approach was, if, you know, she did this interview, and I think she did this interview, and part of the interview she talks about cars having four wheels, and if three of the wheels work and one of them does not work, we just need to get rid of that wheel, right? And she uses this idea of, like, it's broken right now, therefore we need to do away with it. And her approach was never really to reinvest, was never really to think about how we can allocate resources differently. It wasn't about thinking about what are some of the historical wrongs that have been done and how we can rectify those. It was looking at little snapshots and thinking about how we can apply Band-Aid solutions quickly in the name of efficiency to fixing schools. And I think that created this spirit around schools in that local context, but then across the country, about what does it mean to reform education. And I think that we are, as a field in education, we are still grappling with a lot of those assaults and those wrongs of that flawed model of fixing schools. And we see many more districts for a while adopting those practices and really trying to those of us who look at those practices with a critical lens tend to push away from those approaches.
You know, it's interesting. When you were talking, it reminded me of this interview that Melinda Gates did last week, where she talked about, you know, they said your programs really haven't been adopted. And she goes, that's not our goal. Our goal is a disruptor. And it seems like in the privatization movement, that is, it's like we can do it better and we are here to not support and build up schools for the majority of children. Mm-hmm. We are here to disrupt the system.
And to be clear, it's not disrupting white supremacy. It's not disrupting.
Yeah, what are you disrupting? That's what I would have wanted to ask her. What are you disrupting? Because you're taking language and you're co-opting that language for your purposes.
Right.
And, you know, from communities who are using that language to actually talk about disrupting people like you who sort of are imperialists in their view about what schools can and should be, in part because you have a picture of what success is that is not indigenous, that is likely anti-black, right? And you use that language to sort of identify with a particular group of people with whom you likely not have very much conversation about.
Yeah. And what it leads us to is a two-tiered system.
Right.
One that is well-funded and one that is underfunded for low-income kids, kids of color, kids with disabilities. Those are the kids who are not being drawn into, sucked into this other system. Mm-hmm. And here's what it has been good about Betsy DeVos, is that for a long time, both sides of the aisle supported this kind of move to privatization. Mm. And when DeVos arrived, a lot of people woke up to, this is where it's headed. We had no idea this is where it was going. Well, people who were working in this field knew where else could it go. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you brought up I wanted to follow up on, and that you said, this is the happy part of the show. you were talking about interviewing young black men on the inside and outside things that made them successful. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about a little about those, what kinds of things those are?
Yeah, so the students in my book, Urban Preparation, are young men who are part of the first graduating class of a school in Chicago called Urban Prep. And I wanted to, these I actually happen to be my students, former students. I taught them as their ninth grade algebra teacher. And at the time that we did the interviews, they were 4 years post high school on track to completing college within 6 years of their initial enrollment. And what we wanted to know was how this high school or their sort of perspectives about the factors that supported their being successful in college and successful being defined as completing. And part of what they talk about, something that stood out to me, is that a lot of them came from Inglewood, which is a part of Chicago that tends to be depicted on the news, and they talk about this in the book, as, you know, gangs and drugs and a place to be despaired and disavowed. And they talk about that place as home. And what was interesting is that they talk about having navigated Inglewood not as a place to be escape, or not as a place that has hampered their being successful, but they are successful because they're from Inglewood. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the networks that they developed there and the savvy that they sort of cultivated there, and how that savvy has supported their being able to navigate college campuses when they are the only black person on the campus, right? And mm-hmm. they learn how to build relationships and how to connect with people in ways that they really found valuable. Particularly, they place a value on authenticity and building authentic relationships mm-hmm. with folks. And I think part of their growing up in a particular place helped to cultivate that authenticity in terms of showing up as who they are and not trying to perform a particular self to be accepted. And I think that they found that to be really an important part. And this particular school, something that they also said that was really important was that they had to say this creed every day. We're the young men of Urban Prep. We're successful not because we say it, but because we work hard at it. We're dedicated, committed, and focused. And they talk about that creed and getting that self-affirmation as a really important part of their preparation for college. Because even if they felt like they were not academically prepared, and the data and the evidence would say that they weren't necessarily academically prepared for college, that their confidence and belief in their ability to succeed in college was so high, and so it was such an important part of their readiness to go and be successful in college. So those are a couple of things that sort of stick out in terms of their being successful and what they said did that.
So I have two things I want to ask you about, totally divergent. One is what can other communities, what can other schools learn from that? How does that, how can that be transported to a different yeah. school?
I think
what you learned.
Yeah, I think part of what I learned that absolutely can be transported is talk matters. What you say to kids and what you have kids say to themselves every day about who they are and what they can accomplish and where they can go really matters. The school also was really effective in trying to create space for the young men to be exposed to a lot of different experiences and people that where they felt represented. And I think schools can always do the work of getting young people access to opportunities and spaces and people that help them to imagine their futures in ways that go beyond where they live and the everyday experiences that they have. So I think those things stand out as really important. And helping create space in a school, affinity space, where they can be with one another without feeling the judgment or pressure to show up as someone else. Schools historically have, in the U.S., part of the project of American schooling has been to erase people's home identities and to supplant those identities with more mainstream, dominant white ways of knowing and being. And I think this school in a lot of ways still did that, but in other ways really worked hard to help the young men to identify themselves as valuable and to help them feel seen and visible and cared for in ways that they would translate care, right? Because we'll say to teachers, make sure you build relationships with kids, make sure you care about kids, but they do it in a way that is divergent from the ways that those young people would identify care and love, right? And so I think the school helped to really do that. And I think, yeah, those are lessons. Those are just a few things. You got to get the book to get the rest of it.
Yes, and you can get it on Amazon.
Yeah.
Yes. It won't be here till tomorrow, though, just so you know. Was this okay, we only have a minute and a half. Was this an all-boys school?
It was a single, yeah.
And what do you think the benefits or drawbacks are to that?
Uh-oh. Oh.
And we, go ahead.
Yeah. Geez, that's a long conversation, I think.
Okay, should we wait till after the break?
I'll just say quickly, there were some real issues around the concepts of gender and sexuality in the school. And I think if you're in an all single, at any school environment, but I think especially in a single gender school environment, where from the moment these black boys show up, you start to call them young men, and that is how you refer to them, and you refer to them by their surnames, you start to do the work of adultifying them. Mm-hmm. And black boys are already adultified in society, and that has major implications for how they're then criminalized. Mm-hmm. But other than that, we also talk about manhood and masculinity in the book in a ways that a lot of young people felt muted and erased and invisibilized because they didn't perform their gender and sexuality in ways that coalesce with the sort of the mainstream culture of the school. So that was a major issue that I think needs to be brought out. On the flip side of that, they had access to adult black men with whom they could start to do the work of gender and racial socialization. And on the racial socialization side, it actually was good in terms of how these black boys were taught to become black men. There's some things about race that they learned that I think was really beneficial. Mm-hmm. Gender, not so much. So,
It's interesting about the creed. We have 20 seconds. It's interesting about the creed. We had a program here called Mexican American Studies, and it was banned by the state legislature, and then they're bringing it back. Mm-hmm. But one of the things is, at least in the classrooms that I visited, is they had a creed. It was in Spanish, and it was about, it was a mixed gender. Boys and girls were both in the same class. Mm-hmm. But that's so interesting that your school also has a creed, because I had never thought of that as part of the revamping of the inner inner life and the change that that can create.
Absolutely. Words carry power.
Yeah.
So we are going to go for a break, and we will be back in just a minute. And I will tell you about the workshop next Monday when we get back. Monday, 5:30, U of A. Dr. Chesare Warren. Hi, we're back. Sorry. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we are here every Saturday. And today we are talking to Dr. Chesare Warren from the University of Michigan, who's a nationally recognized researcher, and he is speaking on Monday at the University of Arizona in a talk called Race, School Choice, and the Politics of Transformation. And also, one of the people from the Department of Education here, Dr. DeMarcus Jenkins. And
the College of Education.
In the College of
at
Education.
At the University of Arizona.
At the University of Arizona.
Yes. Not to be confused with the Department of Education at Arizona state level.
No. Although we have someone nice in there. So,
lots of good people there.
What the last part of the show is going to be about is the two of you talking about something that you both said was really important, and that is possibility. Mm. And so I'm going to hand it over to you. When it's 1 minute, I'll give you a warning.
Okay.
Not that I pay attention, but it means they're going to turn our show off.
No, I think it's important as we think about what are some of the issues that our schools are facing, we also think about how we can dream and think about the possibility within these spaces, right? And how we can think about what does it mean to create powerful and successful schools for students.
Can I interrupt for just a second? There's a caller who has a quick comment. Hi, Charles.
Yes.
Hi.
This is a fascinating discussion, and it's really interesting to hear some of the things I've never heard before about education and ways to approach it. But I'm curious about one thing, and I do teach. I have a certification from the state in one area of teaching, not in general education. But I hear you worrying about managing the resources that come to education so that the way we've always done it can be preserved. And yet what I don't hear, I mean, is a sort of an embracing of change. And change is inevitable. It happens. Evolution happens. We can't deny it. And so when the ways of education change, instead of resisting it and trying to redivide the pie, what I don't hear in your conversation is sort of a way of teaching people how to embrace, like with racism. It's always going to be there. No one denies it's there. But instead of embracing, fighting it, making everything even, why not embrace how to teach people how to overcome it like Barack Obama did?
Okay. So if you guys could talk about the change that with possibility that, which is a change, which is a breaking up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Charles.
Barack Obama overcame racism. and I think I've written about this a little bit. I think part of what Obama, his body represented a change in America in terms of a more multicultural leadership at the highest levels of state government or federal government. But part of what that also did is created this sort of white backlash in the body of this person who is now elected. And Carol Anderson, in her book White Race, talks about incremental progress. Whenever there's sort of any sort of incremental progress in America, There's always a sort of white backlash that happens. So I think to your point, we do need to talk about race and we do need to talk about change. And we do need to embrace it, particularly in the ways that we can start to have a more pluralistic indigenous view of America, an America that is multicultural and multi-perspectival in the ways that we understand and do our work. And I think that hits at this possibility piece, this dreaming.
And I think a huge part of that is really disrupting how we have come to talk about and understand success when it comes to teaching our students, especially our students who have been historically marginalized, right? So when we think about these measures of success, we think about how we use a rubric to identify good teaching and bad teaching and good leadership and bad teaching and bad leadership. We have to understand how that rubric in so many ways, sometimes in some places, is organized around these white, male, patriarchal ideas and views of what does it mean to be a good teacher or a good leader. And we have to push against that, right? There's some researchers who are doing work. Terrence Green is one who stands out at the University of Texas. He's doing some work that really looks at Black school leadership that goes beyond the schoolhouse walls and goes within the community and think about how can we leverage the resources and the assets that are within communities to really think about leading schools differently, right? And I think it's those approaches to really kind of disrupting how we've come to understand good schools and preparing good educators that I think helps to really ground our conversation and possibility.
Yeah.
So thank you for calling, Charles. So let's. You talked about how this is creating change. It's not going to managing resources. It's creating this change of possibility and transformation. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Can you guys?
Yeah. So something that I've been thinking about a bit more with respect to my work is. So I'll just say, when 45 was elected, I felt this deep sense of mourning. While I know white supremacy is a thing, and he's the full embodiment of it, there is this sense, after 8 years of a Barack Obama presidency, that I thought, okay, maybe we've come, you know, really far, and we can do some stuff, and then this happened. And part of what I determined was that, actually, I'm going to go ahead and center myself on Black joy and Black brilliance and the ways that Black folks have always been creative, and the ways that Black folks, even from the time of, you know, slavery, have always carved out a humanity, to borrow from Derrick Bell. And so part of the possibility and the dreaming is noticing, conditioning ourselves to notice the ways that people of color, indigenous folks, have resisted their oppression, have found ways to create and inspire themselves and dream out loud. And Black kids and kids of color, Latinx folks, do this, and we discount it. Mm-hmm. And I think about even being a teacher. When kids show up in the ways that they show up, bringing their, you know, their cultures and their forms of expression that is specific to them in the local context, and how much I was conditioned as a teacher to not even appreciate the brilliance in their in the ways that they posture themselves and position themselves in school. I think part of the possibility is learning to take a step back and to surrender the authority that we tend to sort of have conferred upon us as we get credentialed mm-hmm. in this society. We take credentials so serious in this society, it just makes us an expert. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting when people call me an expert. I'm like, there's so much. The more I know, the more I realize I don't know. And the more I realize that if I listen to young people, young people can tell us almost any and everything we need to know about improving schools, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's amazing, yeah.
That's what I want. Okay, you guys, youth research. We'll have to come back and talk to you about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so go ahead with what you were going to say.
You know, I was just, in that same vein, I was thinking about, right, how do we revisit or really start to remember, right, this this idea that school, that
shout
traditional
out Cynthia Dillard.
Shout remember. Out remember yeah. right, how do we go back and understand that traditional public schools and schools as anchors within communities, right, and not this movement to disrupt communities by changing schools or by changing neighborhoods, but really starting to because when you reinvest in schools, you are reinvesting in the community. When mm-hmm. you are putting resources there, you are maintaining and you are sustaining institutional landmark for neighborhoods, right? It's the center and the anchor of communities. And I think really going back to eliminating this individualistic idea around we need to compete for schools, but how can we as a collective, as a community, reinvest in these neighborhood resources that mean so much to the people who live there? And you know, and my work really, really starts to recenter schools in that way.
And I will say, those of us who are interested in issues of justice, I really appreciate Eve Tuck and Wang Yang saying, you know, contemporary justice movements must be concerned with both abolition and decolonization.
Yes,
we have
yes,
to reckon
yes.
with the histories of slavery and settler colonialism in the ways that it has shaped every American institution, and thus the precarity of black and brown bodies within those institutions. And the thing is, in noticing and paying attention to that history, it is not for us to distance ourselves or to be ashamed or guilty or sad about it, but to recognize that we're also still here.
Yes.
400 years later, 500 years later, we're still here and we're still creating and we're still persisting. And there is something to be said about the strength and brilliance of these communities to have survived mm-hmm. and not have at the same time burned this country down. have found ways to integrate ourselves and to humanize other people at the same time that we have these long legacies and histories of being dehumanized mm-hmm. as people.
Yeah.
And I think our work is being interested in justice and possibility and dreaming is to notice that history and that brilliance and mm-hmm. to bring that into relief.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was Chesiree Warren, who is also speaking on Monday at the University of Arizona on race, school choice, and the politics of transformation. And I have to say that was a very transformative talk you just gave.
Yeah.
Oh,
and powerful.
You. Yeah.
So I want to thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
And I want to talk to one of you at some point about activating student voice. Does this sound familiar?
Yes,
love to have that conversation.
Wi-Fi, yeah.
So,
thank you very much for coming in. We'll be here next week, and Al will be doing the show, and we are here every week on my side of the show. We're usually talking about education, but we're always talking about social justice and what we can change mm-hmm. in our community, in our world. And
tell me again about that talk on Monday.
That talk on Monday is...
What was that you mentioned?
Monday, April 22nd from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And it is Race, School Choice, and the Politics of Transformation. And the person giving it is our wonderful guest today, Chesiree Warren, who is an assistant professor of teacher education at Michigan State University. So thank you. We'll
Come
see you next
support.
Week.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.